than 100 years ago, in what was then the new Beacon Religious Education Program, Ella Lyman Cabot wrote, "We sometimes speak as if the past were over and done with. That's past. That's out of date. That's ended. Yet try to obliterate in your thought all that is past." It's impossible, of course, because in so doing, we obliterate ourselves. Without the help of what we call the past, we could not live at all. The past, instead of being done with, is then the real fiber of the world as we know it. Just as the food we eat nourishes us till it becomes what we act with, so the past is always what we think with. The past is always what we think with. So here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, with seemingly endless wars and economic and environmental challenges, and this past that we think with is missing major pieces. Information about the women and other marginalized groups who were part of our history. How can we think about creating a better world when we're missing key elements of the toolkit we need to think with? As Unitarian Universalists, we cannot understand our faith unless we know the wisdom and stories of both women and men who stand before us in our great religious tradition. What meaning did these liberal religious faiths have for them? What spiritual insights led them to choose or maintain their faith? And how did these religious perspectives inform their lives? Today, I've chosen four of the many women it was my privilege to come to know through my work with the UU Women's Heritage Society and the creation of the anthology Standing Before Us. And although although these four women are all white, they all were also actively involved in advocacy for people of color and other marginalized people. The first two women I'm going to talk about, and thanks to the internet, we have visual aids here. If you look at the cover of your order of service, the first two women that I'm going to talk about are the women on the left. The top woman is Judith Sargent Murray, and below her is Margaret Fuller, and then over on the right is Lucy Stone and Mary Livermore. And those are the four women that are also listed with their dates in your order of service. The first two women I'm going to talk about provided the spiritual and intellectual grounding for a major shift in thinking concerning the relationships between the sexes. The other two used this understanding to provide leadership in what became known as the women's suffrage movement. This movement led to the passage of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, acknowledging, I don't like to say giving women the right to vote, I think it's acknowledging women's right to vote. Today we take this right for granted and forget that it was nearly 100 years ago that more than 70 years of organized work led to the passage of that amendment. Sometimes we tend to give up, but we need to remember that it took 70 years from the first meeting in Seneca Falls to the passage of the amendment. So the women I'm going to talk about are two Universalists, Judith Sargent Murray and Mary Livermore, and two Unitarians, Margaret Fuller and Lucy Stone. And they were all instrumental in this paradigm shift, which obviously is still going on today. And if these names are not immediately familiar to you, and I have to say I have a classmate here from Pomona College where I had a very excellent undergraduate education back in the 60s, and I never heard of any of these women. I suspect that many of you have not as well. And it's because their stories and their importance has not really been integrated into the way we think about history. For too long, our understanding of religious and social history has been limited by focusing only on the lives of men, white men at that. Women, however, were often the ones to activate and demonstrate the value of our faith, such as freedom, tolerance, acceptance of diversity, and individual rights. They translated liberal theology into real work to promote justice in the world. Their faith gave them the courage to rise up against the tide of their times to make the world a better place. The first of these women, Judith Sargent, was born in Gloucester, Massachusetts in 1751 into a family that had accumulated wealth over several generations. Active in the community, they were cultured and politically aware. Judith learned basic reading and writing skills and read everything she had access to pretty much on her own. Because she was not allowed to join her brother in his preparation for Harvard, she began to question the inequality of women. When she was 19, her father discovered an early Universalist book and gathered friends together to discuss this new theology. And when he learned that a British preacher of the theology was nearby, he invited John Murray to come to Gloucester. Judith recognized immediately that she had found a spiritual teacher. She was already married, but she hoped they could be intellectual companions. And she wrote to him, "I am not much accustomed to writing letters, especially to your sex. But if there be neither male nor female in the Emmanuel you promulgate, we may surely, and with the strictest propriety, mingle souls upon paper." In 1779, Judith became one of the founders, a woman, was listed as a founder of the first Universalist Church in America, along with an African-American man, Gloucester Dalton. John Murray was the first minister, and a few years later, Judith's husband died, and she and John were married. It was a little more than mingling souls on paper, apparently. Judith continued to educate herself and share that education with others, particularly those in her extended family, and she taught children from the new Universalist Church. In response to a request from church leaders, Judith wrote what is considered the first American Universalist explanation of religious education. In the preface, she continued her efforts to bridge the gender divide. Now, remember, this is at a time when nobody is saying stuff like this. So this was an unusual thing to put into her religious education materials. It's in 18th century language, so you have to kind of listen carefully. I'll try to read it as well as I can. "If there is anything that ought for the moment to take the place of those exquisite sensations which we boastfully term peculiarly feminine, it is surely a sacred attention to those interests that are crowned with immortality. Whatever is essential to the ethereal spark which animates these transient tenements will exist when the distinction of male and female shall be forever absorbed." So she has a vision back in the mid 18th century of male and female merging. In 1790, she wrote what is generally acknowledged as the first essay on women's rights published in America. It appeared in Massachusetts Magazine and was entitled "On the Equality of the Sexes." And the story goes that her husband didn't even realize she wrote it because it had the pseudonym Constancia, which men would use a female name often. Anyway, she went on to publish poems and more essays and later completed and published her husband's autobiography. Now, as with the other women I'm introducing today, I hope you will be intrigued about them and want to learn more. For now, I hope you remember that Judith Sargent Murray drew on her Universalist faith in publicly challenging the gender norms of her day. In so doing, she set the stage for the movement that was to emerge a century after her birth. Now, the next woman, Margaret Fuller, was born in 1810 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to an educated and politically active family. They were not wealthy, however, but were among the early Unitarians. Margaret's father was elected to the Massachusetts Senate when she was 3 years old. By then, by 3 years old, he was already teaching her to read. By age 5, she was learning arithmetic and English and Latin grammar. Although she only attended school sporadically, she gained an excellent education, directed first by her father and then by her own quest for knowledge. She began teaching her younger siblings and later tutored young men preparing for Harvard. She couldn't go to Harvard, but she could tutor men to go to Harvard. Quite an achievement in an era when education for girls was considered highly questionable. Now, among Margaret's close friends were several men who were studying for Unitarian ministry at Harvard, including my namesake, Waldo Emerson, our namesake, and others who were already established writers and thinkers. Her deeply personal and intellectual conversations with them helped them shape their ideas. But because of her gender, she struggled to find her voice and her vocation. And her struggle led her to invent new ways, new forms for herself and others. Recognizing the lack of opportunities for women, she created new educational opportunities called conversations. These gatherings encouraged women to read, think, and articulate their ideas in an era when they were not supposed to have their own thoughts or speak in public. In so doing, she empowered the next generation of women writers and leaders. Margaret was also part of the Transcendentalist Circle and became the first editor of its journal, The Dial. In this work, she joined with luminaries like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Elizabeth Peabody, and Theodore Parker to create the first major new philosophical and spiritual movement in America. But her most famous contribution was the book she wrote called Woman in the 19th Century. Published in 1845 by Universalist Horace Greeley, this small volume found its way to upstate New York to the women who 3 years later called the first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls. Later, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, leaders of that movement, wrote that Margaret Fuller, quote, possessed more influence on the thought of American women than any woman previous to her time. These first two women, Judith Sargent Murray and Margaret Fuller, were trailblazers of ideas. Their primary venues were writing and teaching. They paved the way for those who followed to use their ideas as foundations for the women's suffrage movement. As Unitarian Universalists today, we need to know these women whose faith in the religious tradition we share, empowered them to think for themselves and articulate new ideas that would inspire generations to come. Now, our next two women were two of the great organizers and public speakers of the women's suffrage and other social reform movements of the 19th century. As children, now neither, in a sense, both Judith and Margaret were born into the faith or received it from their families. Our next two women were born in more orthodox Christianity and rebelled against it. So they both questioned the beliefs and practices, and they were, as children, raising these issues. And then they found their way to Unitarian Universalism as young adults. Lucy Stone was born on a farm in 1818 in Massachusetts. As a young girl, she questioned the position of women in the Bible. Her daughter wrote that Lucy was reading the Bible one day and was, quote unquote, filled with horror. She knew the laws and customs were against the women, but it never occurred to her that God could be against them. Lucy's first public confrontation concerning women's rights came in her congregational church at a meeting to decide if the congregation should expel one of the members for anti-slavery activities. She raised her hand to vote in objection and was told her vote would not count because she was a woman. So the whole idea of voter fraud is really present with us today, only it's maybe not because you're a woman, but some people are being turned away. So good to remember this history. Anyway, her father refused to send her to university because she was a girl, of course, but she earned her own way to Oberlin College and became the first woman in Massachusetts to graduate from college. And it was at college where she first declared herself a Unitarian. When Lucy returned to Massachusetts, she began giving public speeches against slavery and for women's rights. Because she was one of the first to speak publicly in favor of women's suffrage, she was called the Morning Star of the women's movement. She also became a leader in the movement to end slavery, and then went on from there to work for women's right to vote. She traveled all over the country, and this is always something that I kind of wish I had a movie I could show of this, but think of the sort of mid-19th century, and she's traveling, she goes to every state in the country at the time, and she goes by train, by stagecoach, and horse-drawn carriage. And she's she attempts to address every state legislature to persuade them to change the laws. But she also wanted her presence in these communities to inspire ongoing political action. So she got groups of women together and organized education and action groups in every community she visited. And she also wrote pamphlets to educate women about political process. I preached in a church in Santa Maria, in Santa Paula, California, where there was a women's group that had been organized by Mary Livermore. Oh, Mary Livermore was the next woman. Oops, I got that wrong. They both traveled the country, gave speeches, and organized groups. So that for, I'm jumping ahead to Mary Ashton Rice Livermore. Born in Boston in 1820 to a strict Calvinist family. At an early age, she began questioning her family's Baptist religion, especially the belief that some people were saved and others were not. When she was 7 and a baby sister was born, she pleaded with her parents to send it back to God rather than risking that it might not be chosen to be saved. And later, the bad thing happened, and another sister died before she was baptized. At that time, Mary was a teenager, and she declared that she would rather go to hell and be with her sister than go to heaven with a God that would damn an innocent soul to eternal torment. So these experiences set the stage for Mary's discovery of Universalism. And her marriage to a young Universalist minister, Daniel Livermore. Together, they served several Massachusetts parishes before moving to Chicago, where they co-edited The New Covenant, a Universalist social reform journal. During the Civil War, Mary became a leader in the Sanitary Commission, a forerunner of the Red Cross. Besides frequent trips to the battlefield, she began her career as a public speaker to raise money for much-needed supplies. In the process, she also helped organize thousands of local aid societies. After the war, the Livermores came back to the Boston area. Mary's fame as a lecturer grew, and for the next century, she traveled from coast to coast and to Europe, delivering over 3,000 lectures and earning the accolade Queen of the platform. In one of Mary's best-known speeches, "What Shall We Do with Our Daughters?" which she is said to have delivered over 800 times, she challenged people to think about the future for the young women in their care. She advocated for full education for girls so that they might be prepared to support themselves and live independent lives. This is in the 18th century, remember? And she's advocating for girls to learn to have independent lives, to be able to have independent lives. She chided her audience for their, quote, culpability in neglecting to give their daughters some knowledge of business affairs. With utter indifference, she said, girls are allowed to grow into womanhood unfamiliar with the most ordinary forms of business transactions. Unfortunately, this is still too often the case today. So each of these women raised issues that are still of concern today, but they also made a difference in their own time, in the lives of women, and in the lives of men who were beginning to consider these possible ideas that women and men could be equal. They were inspired by their Unitarian and Universalist faith to step beyond their comfort zones and speak out for what they believed was right. We are the inheritors of this tradition as much as we are the inheritors of this church building and this congregation's history. As such, we have a responsibility to reincarnate the essence of our faith in the context of the challenges of our generation, to blend our efforts with those of the past, to continue this living stream of Unitarian Universalism. UU minister Keith Goheen writes, "We study history so that those who have labored before will not have done so vainly. And we do it so their work, now mingled with ours, will offer Unitarian Universalism's redemptive power to those who follow us. For our understanding of history to be complete, however, we must include women and people of color. We need all our history because the past is what we think with. You've heard the saying that what you don't know can't hurt you, but I'm not so sure about that. The past we do not know may be the very information that we need to help us survive and to grow. Not knowing the past can hurt us because the problems we face today require the strength and insight that we need from the past. Even though we don't know it, it's in us. It's part of an inner well of resources that we can use to mingle our work with as we go forward. Make the world better were the last audible words said by Lucy Stone. I believe that's what we all want to do. And I, for one, am grateful to have discovered these women and many others who led the way. May they also inspire you to continue the work of making this world a better place. Amen.